And we welcome you to Monday's morning show on WGTD HD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva, your gateway to public radio. I'm Gregory Berg. On today's morning show, we are continuing the conversation which I recorded late last week with entertainer Bill Hayes, a much-loved, much-admired artist who came to prominence in the early 1950s, first on television's Your Show of Shows with Sid Caesar, and then on Broadway with Me and Juliet of Rodgers and Hammerstein, and on to an acting career which eventually took him to the soap opera Days of Our Lives, where he met and married beautiful Susan Seaforth, soon to become Susan Seaforth Hayes. We'll hear from her a little bit later on in this conversation. We're going to replay a portion of Friday's morning show in which he talks about his experience on Broadway, the transition from television to the Broadway stage, and then about all that ensued, this long, wonderful career of the great Bill Hayes. What did it feel like to be shifting from what you had done on Your Show of Shows, which was a different little adventure every single week, to something like this, which was one huge project? And you worked, I assume, for weeks, maybe months, before this big project opened. I mean, I should think that felt very different in some ways. Was it difficult to work in that kind of way?
It was different, yes. We had 5 weeks of rehearsal before we opened at the Anna Theater in Cleveland, and then they made changes. So you might come in the next day and say, "Well, we're doing this. Here are your new pages for that scene, and that scene is out, and we fixed and changed." There was a song in Me and Juliet that Joe Lautner sang, called "The Big Black Giant." He had a beautiful bass voice. And they ended up, after the run in Cleveland, and said, "It's not right for him to sing that song. Bill Hayes should sing that song." So suddenly they did an arrangement in E-flat, and I sang "The Big Black Giant." But it was, you're right, we had more rehearsal time, but it was still, with all the changes, you had to be malleable.
Of course. It's like you never knew what would be coming next.
Once we opened, they didn't change a thing. Once we opened on Broadway, that was it. That was the show. And Dick Rogers was a stickler. No phrasing. "No other love have I, 2, 3, 4, hold all right to the end and then grab a quick breath. The only my love for you," all the eighth notes, anticipating the bar lines and everything. He wanted it sung that way. He said, you go in a club or record it, you can sing it any way you want. But on this stage, it's my show, and you do it the way I wrote it. That's it.
Wow. And I assume back then, although I could be wrong, that you had nothing like the amplification that now you have all the time on Broadway. Was there some amplification of the voices, or mostly was it just your voices needing to project into the hall on their own?
Zip. No amplification. We sang in stagey keys, therefore. I mean, if you were going to sing it in the best key for your voice, you might choose one key, but for the stage, you'd had to project, and so they sang it a little bit higher and a little more demandingly. Yeah. We sang "No Other Love" in A flat, and it ends with an A flat. I'm one up there.
the excerpt from Me and Juliet that I have actually queued up is actually a fun moment from the show called "That's the Way It Happens," which is, I think, one of the duets that you sing, right?
Yes, I sang it first as almost like an opening number in the show. I sang it first, and then Isabel Bigley sang a chorus of it.
Here is a little bit of that fun song again. This is Bill Hayes in Rodgers and Hammerstein's Me and Juliet from the original Broadway cast recording.
You're a guy in New Haven on the road with a show. There's a girl in the company that you hardly know. You watch her and you wonder if she'd like to partake of French fried potatoes and a T-bone steak. Then along comes a fellow who is quicker than you, and he does what you thought that you would like to do. He takes her to a bistro where they give you a break with French fried potatoes and a T-bone steak. Now you see them together and you know in your heart that you lost what you wanted at the very start, because you didn't ask her if she'd like to partake of French fried potatoes and a T-bone steak. That's the way it happens. That's the way it happens. That's the way it happens.
There it is, a moment from Me and Juliet by Rodgers and Hammerstein, sung by Bill Hayes. What were Rodgers and Hammerstein like to work with in this show? You've already told us about Mr. Rodgers being very exacting and precise. Were they supportive directors or intimidating or a little of both?
Both of them were so professional and so supportive. I worked with Dick Rodgers in years after, where he was a conductor, and he knew the music, and he was an excellent conductor. He heard everything. If someone played a sixth and there wasn't a sixth in the chord, he knew it, and he knew who played it.
Wow.
Oscar Hammerstein was of course involved with the words. If I can remember George Abbott staging a scene and it being rather confusing to Isabel Bigley and me, and after the scene was all done and we went to work on something else, Oscar came up and said, "Well, think of it this way." So he saw that we were struggling with something, and he came and put it straight. They were both very helpful. I am such an admirer of both of them. I did a show of Rodgers and Hart music. We sang Cogie Grant, and I sang like 52, 54 songs of Rodgers and Hart. And Rodgers is so creative in all those Rodgers and Hart songs. And then he changed his style, and when the words came from Oscar Hammerstein, his music changed. He went with the heart of Oscar Hammerstein. Is such a creative fellow. And then Hammerstein, I loved what he did. The man is a great man.
Well, what a thrill for you to be a part of a Broadway history as one of the leads in this really intriguing show. Not in their top five or six in terms of highest grossing shows, but a commendable part of their legacy, and there you were at the heart of it. The thrill of a lifetime.
Well, you're right. Thrill of a lifetime.
After that, you have the number one song in the country.
Correct.
With the Ballad of Davy Crockett, and can you just say a word about how this came about?
Yes. Archie Blyer called me on December 15th, 1954, and said, "Are you still recording with MGM Records?" And I said, "Nope." He said, "Could you record a song with me, Cadence Records?" I said, "Yep." He said, "Come by the office, please. I have a song." I went by his office about 12:30 that day, and he had a lead sheet of the Ballad of Davy Crockett. Let's sing through it. I sang through it. He said, do you like it? I said, I love it. He said, do you want to record it? I said, yes. He said, tonight? I said, yes. And that's what happened. He went off and wrote the orchestration and called the instrumentalist. I went off and studied the song, and we met at 10 o'clock that night, and we recorded it one take.
Mm. Here's just a snip of the Ballad of Davy Crockett, which at the time was Billboard's number one song in the country and sung by Bill Hayes.
Davy, Davy Crockett, the king of the wild frontier. Born on a mountaintop in Tennessee, the greenest state in the land of the free. Raised in the woods so's he knew every tree, and kilt him a bar when he was only three. Davy, Davy Crockett, the king of the wild frontier.
I wonder, was it fun to sort of adapt what you would typically do into the, you know, kind of a new genre? I mean, trying to sound like you were somebody out of the Western frontier that way?
Well, yes, it was. But I had been doing that all along, switching to whatever this number that I was doing was had its own style. This was just another version of that. I had sung hillbilly songs. I had sung folk songs, cowboy songs, country. Well, this was sort of all in the middle of all that. And so I just went with whatever felt like was right for the song.
And ultimately, your career included a great deal of cabaret singing as well.
Yes.
I wonder if you could just say a word about how singing felt for you in those kind of settings where you're holding a mic in more intimate surroundings, not on a stage projecting to a, you know, to a large audience in a large hall, but it's a very, very different situation, particularly for the audience. How different was it for you as the singer to be singing in those situations?
It was quite different. I came to admire saloon singers and people who worked in clubs, because it is a totally different genre, different style, different. I put the keys much lower so that the projection was not first. The microphone did the projecting, and soft crooning sounds were much more fitted. I still would use quote money notes, but sometimes the orchestra was large, sometimes the orchestra was small, and you have to adjust to that. I learned a lot by working in clubs. Didn't do a lot of it, but I did enough. Sang enough in vaudeville houses and in clubs too. To perfect a vocal microphone technique is quite different.
And it sure seems like one way or another you have done things right in terms of preserving the essential beauty of your voice so very well after all these years of singing. What would you attribute your longevity to, as your longevity vocally speaking? Anything in particular that you did, or is that partly the good fortune of nature, of kind of the body and voice you were blessed with? To what do you attribute the fact that your voice is still quite lovely at the age of 89?
Well, I would say that when I was at Northwestern working with John Toms, I learned a lot. And that sustained me a lot. I learned on Broadway after many weeks of singing and speaking on Broadway that if I put a little edginess, a brightness on my tone, it carried better. I didn't have to sing so loud or speak so loud. That was very helpful. I've done some plays where I'm on stage the whole time, sometimes shouting through the whole show. And if I put an edge on the sound, it carries more. And I don't have to work so hard. and that's been helpful to me. I found out early in life that smoke and drink make singing difficult. On Broadway, one night I went out to dinner between the matinee and evening show, and everybody else was having a glass of wine, so I had a glass of wine. Well, relaxed my chords enough so that the A flat at the end of No Other Love was extremely high. It was like a, you know, tones higher. It was very difficult. So I fortunately have not been addicted to those. I don't know.
Learned a good lesson there.
Yeah, that was a big one. I remember the night. Wow, was it high.
You mentioned earlier on that your father sang to you just about every morning when you and your brothers would wake up. I'm trying to remember, have you, among all of life's experiences, been a father yourself?
Yes, I in college, married Mary Hobbs, and we had five children. I still have four of them, and then 12 grandchildren and 21 great-grands.
And did you try to make your home sort of the same music-filled home that you grew up in Harvey, Illinois?
Yes. Yes, absolutely. I love music, and music's good for the soul. And all my kids, none of them went into singing to make a living, but they all have enjoyed singing and enjoyed music a lot.
Very good.
Yep.
All right, I've paused the tape. This has been just great and so much fun. If we should finish up with just a couple words about Days of Our Lives, if you don't mind, unless maybe you have to go.
No, I don't have to go.
Okay.
And Susan is back home, and she's ready whenever you would like to have her join in.
That's great. If she wants to get on the other line, we will we'll finish up by talking about this chapter of your lives. That'd be
okay.
Great. So.
Let me find her here. There she is.
Hey.
This is Greg Berg.
How do you do, Greg?
I am so
talking with you.
So excited to be talking with you, too. At this point in our interview, I'm delighted to say that we are joined by the beautiful wife of Bill Hayes, Susan Seaforth Hayes. And at this point, we get to talk about the really exciting collaboration, which they've enjoyed in a number of different ways, including co-authoring a couple of highly regarded books, and of course their performances over the course of many, many years on Days of Our Lives. Susan Seaforth Hayes, why don't you tell us about the day you first met Bill Hayes? I understand it was sort of bedazzlement at first sight, at least on your part.
Well, I had purchased Bill's records. I also had a copy of the Ballad of Davy Crockett and various other songs that he had recorded. I had seen him on television and been quite a fan, of course, of your show of shows. And I had seen him in the theater when he did Bye Bye Birdie. I was ushering one time at the theater there. You would get to see the show for free if you ushered, so I did, and I did. And the sight of him singing Put on a Happy Face from the second balcony was very transformative. I thought he was adorable. And I was a long way back in the theater from him, but so I knew of him as a fan and as a pop singer. Then he's suddenly on the show, and he is hired as an actor, not necessarily as a singer.
And, of course, the show we're talking about is the soap opera Days of Our Lives. And you'd been on, I think, for a couple of years at that point.
At that point, it had been on maybe 4 years.
Mm-hmm.
And there was plenty of soap opera on, various other shows, a lot of them in New York, all of which are gone now. But the mood on most soap operas at that time, and I had worked on others, I'd worked on General Hospital, was rather drear. There were stories of based around hospitals. There were stories about lawyers and doctors and guys in suits and ties and pain and anguish and unrequited love. more pain and anguish than mystery, violence, or romance.
Hmm.
So Bill Hayes turns up, and the writer of the show, Bill Bell, who went on to create other soap operas, including The Young and the Restless and Bold and Beautiful, immediately realized that he had something new in the cast member. All of our actors were established and good and dramatic actors, but here was a guy that could do everything and more than carry a tune. So he came on as a rogue character, as a lawbreaker who was in fact discovered in prison. Blue-collar crimes, but still, not blue-collar, white-collar crimes, but still basically a bad guy, an opportunist, a charmer. Well, that character developed into the Bill Hayes that America fell in love with, even as I had. And they began to insinuate music into the show. They were able to insinuate music into the show because Bill Hayes could write his own arrangements, sing in tune, suggest songs that were appropriate to a situation. And as soon as possible, they put him in a restaurant, and then they gave him the ownership of the restaurant so he could sing anytime he showed up.
Very handy.
Very handy, with a pianist in the background.
Ah.
Then they added Robert Clary eventually to the show and other singers to the show. Kay Stevens was on the show for a long run. Gloria Loring, Patti Weaver. Gloria's still singing. Robert Clary is still Bill's closest friend. So that element of music added so much romance. It wasn't as though you were playing a love song in the background. It was the guy that you wanted could sing the song to you. Big difference.
Absolutely. Not
other
just something playing in the background.
And
yeah. And
attempted to copy it with limited success. Immediately on CBS, characters were turning up with a guitar, having told the producer, no, I can sing. And they would discover that you had to pay for most of the music, so you wound up hearing the Battle Hymn of the Republic, sung with mixed emotion by an unqualified actor who said he could sing.
Oh, dear.
But Bill went on and really turned the show around.
We sang a lot through the 70s. There was a lot of music.
A lot of music, and it would underscore the plots, our romance was considered very popular when Time Magazine did a review of all of the soaps that were on the air. They wanted to do a cover story on pop culture, which was, of course, soap opera. They interviewed all the shows and took pictures of all the actors, but in the end, they put Bill Hayes on the cover of Time Magazine with me.
Yeah.
Which was a big boost to all of our feelings of being recognized by the country.
Right. Well, and when you think about who's been on the cover of Time, I mean, Franklin Roosevelt, Mahatma Gandhi, and Bill and Susan Seaforth Hayes.
Yeah, and a few murderers, despots, and no counts, but
right.
We got to be on it, too.
Absolutely.
And
I have to.
He really changed the face of daytime television. And, of course, then I had to catch up, which I never did, but I could try. I began to take some voice lessons, and I was lucky enough to do a few musicals with Billy, which was terrific.
Yeah.
I got to do 42nd Street with him once. Just before we were married, I did 8 O' Annie in Oklahoma with him, playing Curly, of course. And Oliver, Mame, these were great experiences for me. Also, I had started, my first paying job was as Trouble in Madame Butterfly, and discovered that my darling loved the opera more than anything, and we have spent the rest of our 40 years of marriage and 44 years of friendship going to the opera all over the world and sharing that and having opera singers for friends. We became friends with Richard Cassely and Patricia Craig Cassely, continue to be her close friend, and she's teaching a voice in San Francisco now when she left the Met. So
Music's been a huge
part of our life together.
Mm.
And I used to think that all the riches in the world came through your eyes. Not necessarily the gold you could clutch, because I've never had gold to clutch. But to me, the arts were painting and cinema and the visual arts. But knowing Bill, and maybe even in the last 5 years, I've begun to understand that the riches that you receive through the joy of hearing are just as precious, if not more so, and of course, eternal.
Right. That reminds me of one of the clips from Days of Our Lives that I think is especially beautiful is the occasion of a wedding anniversary of two of the older characters. It would be the characters played by Francis Reed and
MacDonald Carey. And Francis Reed.
Right.
Yes.
And for, I think, maybe their 40th or 50th wedding anniversary, Bill Hayes is serenading this table full of family members with the song Always,
yes.
Kind of the theme song of the family. And I think this comes at a moment when the two of you, who are both in real life and on the show, had been married. That is, your character's
We're
married.
Estranged
yeah,
at that
but
moment.
At that moment, you're estranged. So he's
I
singing
can't remember
this.
Remember what the problem was, but when I look at that clip, I say, "Gee, I must have been having a big problem."
Right. Well, and I know the two characters were divorced at least once before
Twice,
getting married.
Yes.
But it's a beautiful scene, not only because he takes the microphone around this table of various family members and kind of shares the mic with various castmates, two at a time. From you, we don't really hear any singing as much as we just see you as you're listening to especially him sing.
Yes.
And it's a beautiful moment that sort of underscores how powerful music is, and especially when there is a song that means so much to you.
It means so much to so many people. Performed that song again more recently when the show opened a big new set that had been built in honor of the characters that were played. It's called the Horton Town Square. And the characters that were played by Mac and Francis, who have both passed away, were immortalized by this this imaginary town center in the imaginary town of Salem Anywhere, USA, which is where Days of Our Lives takes place.
So we sang a duet version of Always.
And we sang a duet of I'll Be Loving You Always, which was very sentimental for us and very nerve-wracking at the same time for me.
Sure. But how fun for you to have a collaborator like your husband, Bill, in this
collaborator.
Venture. Right. Not too shabby.
No.
I know the two of you have collaborated on two books as well.
Absolutely.
As a matter of fact, you have a dual memoir which I bought when it first came out and enjoyed, and of course I couldn't lay my hands on it this morning. I have about 1,000 books at home, so couldn't find it, unfortunately, but I remember reading Sands Through the Hourglass, I think
Thank
is the name
you.
Of it. Yeah.
Yes, we put that together in 5 months walking to opposite ends of the house and saying, how do you remember how this happened? Well, I remember it this way. Well, I remember it that way. So we wrote it in two voices, and we came in on our deadline, and our editor was astonished. We said, why is that? Said, writers never make their deadline. I said, well, we're from show business. If you don't make the deadline, you get the job. So,
fair enough.
We enjoyed doing that a lot, and we've had some nice success with this. And then following that, our editor suggested that we should write a novel together because she felt that though we were happy in our work as actors and Bill as a musician, we really were a hidden talent was in writing. So we spent the next seven years researching and traveling the world, creating a story about a female performer in the age of Napoleon, and went to the Waterloo battle site and even to Egypt because we tied her story in with another famous historical character of the period called Belzoni. So we learned a lot about theater and music in England at the time of Jane Austen, which is also the same period. So we had a wonderful time doing that. And the name of that book is Trumpet. And people look at it and look it up online and see it's a, it must be a textbook for playing the trumpet. But no, it's her family name.
Ah, actually, I was going to ask you about that. I also, I heard an interview that the two of you gave at the time that that was published, in which you said that the two of you grew incredibly close. I mean, as close as you'd already been, you grew even closer through the course of writing these two books, and especially this second one. I'm just curious, what was it about writing this book together that drew you closer? I mean, what about the writing process made that happen?
Well, two brains are better than one. And, for example, Bill can write in iambic pentameter without any stress whatsoever. And he will come up with a whole scene in an imaginary play. Just like that, and I can't possibly do that. I'm agog, and then I'll say, but what were they wearing? But what was the response in the house? What was the air like at the time? What were the tastes? What was the sensuality of the moment? So I did a lot of color, and build a lot of dialogue, and then we would evaluate each other with loving tolerance. And the final editing was the two of us sitting side by side with large format in front of the computer and saying, what do you think of it? No. We use that word three chapters back. We have to have another word for that. No, that's extraneous. No, we've already covered that. Keep it moving.
And
it was great. There's nothing like collaborating on a work of art with someone you respect. I would highly recommend it for all marriages which are under a bit of stress. Try creating something besides each other's temper, you know, nagging at each other's temper.
Right.
But it's strange. We did learn a lot from each other just going through that process.
Hmm. Yes.
Terrific. I want to also give you a chance to just say a word about, let's call it, the often maligned world of soap opera. That is, then and now. It's often an assumption people make that we're talking about acting and writing and production that is, you know, a level down from, for instance, primetime television or other kinds of
Correct.
Of television
well, it's
programming
a level down and down generally in budget. Okay, so the story is extremely important. You're liable to see a repetition of sets. The acting is extremely important because in your movie stars, in your greatest stars, how many hours of your life did you spend with them? Even if they did 50 movies, even if you saw the movie several times, we're talking about dozens of hours or maybe, in an extreme case, maybe if you saw every Spencer Tracy film three times, 100 hours. Garbo, maybe 12 hours. Even Tom Hanks, how many hours have you spent with him? But in the soap situation, you have spent thousands and thousands of hours with these actors. And if they captured your imagination, held your attention, touched you emotionally, uplifted you, this is a great achievement. So the people who have lasted in soap are not only facile, they're pretty damn good.
Right, absolutely.
It's rare that people transition out of being soap opera stars into being movie stars. It has happened. It does happen. But generally, you have so much work going on, and the money begins to flow in a way that you didn't expect, and you're raising a family, and you say, well, I like it here in Connecticut, or, you know, this isn't so bad living in Studio City, California. Maybe I just want to go on with it instead of dumping it once.
And but I understand
and a lot of it has to do with what your agent tells you should be doing. You know, a lot of careers have been destroyed by the bungling agent getting in the middle.
Mm. I understand the people who deride soap. That's what I thought it was. I thought it was lower, a set below, until I got on it. But I had never seen it, so.
Yeah, so most of the people that are saying aha soap opera or aha fiction are missing a lot. there's often a lot of good culture and pop culture, as Susan Sontag discovered. You didn't have to have read all the great books to know something. Hmm. Some people just had talent.
Right.
Yeah.
But when I got on Days, I realized very quickly how wonderful the actors were. and the writing. It's what a feat. Days of Our Lives started in 1965.
And it's still there.
And it's about, this November, it's its 50th anniversary.
Wow. Wow.
And, most of the original audience has moved to a higher plane, but they have managed to capture new audience with new cast, and it's been a revolving door for writers and producers. So it's just always been a really good show.
Absolutely. It's one I remember my mother watching very faithfully back in the 1960s, and I would, every so often when I'd be home from school for one reason or another, would peer over her shoulder. So even from the days when the two of you were first on the program, I was probably getting a peek of you at you from time to time, and still enjoy catching up with the good folks of Salem, as I know you enjoy the occasional visits which you get to make to the program.
We still love it.
When I teach about opera, I often mention to newcomers to opera, I mean when it's a group of students who aren't music majors or whatever, and we're talking about the plots of certain operas, which are sometimes a bit far-fetched, where some character walks into the room and sees a woman in a cloak and jumps to the conclusion that it's not her or whatever. And, never in grand opera, people never bother to ask a question first. They just leap to conclusions, and, of course, all mayhem ensues. But that's one of the things that generates the
excitement.
Absolutely.
And the emotional highs. It goes from emotional high to emotional high.
Right. And in some respects, it's probably not a coincidence that soap opera has the word opera in it, because to some extent, some of the plots of juicy soap operas are kind of driven by some of the same elements. As opera fans, do you see a parallel there as well?
Oh, sure.
Yes. What could be a better soap than Cab and Peg?
True enough.
I mean, both of them are so charged with passion. Cavalleria rusticana.
Yeah.
The
immediate consequences.
Pagliacci, so loaded with intense passion at its height. Ridi Pagliaccio. What could be more like a soap? Wonderful.
Absolutely. So you guys, in addition to all that keeps you busy, get out to the opera on a fairly regular basis from the sounds of it.
We have been attending the Los Angeles Opera since it was the New York City Opera on tour.
Ah.
We have finally achieved fourth row center.
Moving up in the world. Huh?
Moving up in the world. We have had our tickets for so long, and we're very much enjoying the Met in HD. I mean, that has become the great Saturday morning treat for us to sit amongst all those old Russian ladies who also attend and go to the Metropolitan Opera.
And the Los Angeles Opera, we've been going to their seasons for almost 25 years now. They do wonderful work. They really are good.
Absolutely.
LA Opera has. We've watched it grow and do some fantastic work. Yeah.
Absolutely.
Placido is the artistic director, and I think he has a lot to say. James Conlon is their principal conductor.
Yeah, James Conlon.
He's wonderful.
When James Conlon first came to L.A. and was doing these lectures prior to the performance, they had somebody that would ask him a leading question. It was supposed to be an interview. They were supposed to be asking him questions. Well, the first time I heard him speak, they asked one question, and he went on for 45 minutes. And by the third time, they didn't bother with a person quizzing him. Oh, they just give him the microphone and let him go. And
he's amazing. Every night that he's conducting, he does the lecture beforehand from 6:30 to 7:15.
Yeah.
He talks, and he's wonderful.
And I don't know how he has the energy to conduct. He gives so much in these lectures. And they're a massively attended now. I think he has a great following in Los Angeles. It's very lucky to have him. And I hope his health continues to be good.
He has a very good following in the Chicago area, too, at the Ravinia Festival, which is the summer home of the Chicago Symphony Orchestra.
Yeah.
And presides over all kinds of exciting things there, including this summer Wagner's Flying Dutchman. So we know the name of James Conlon very well around here.
Yeah,
so.
He conducted a Dutchman for us last season.
Very good. Well, this is a delight to talk with both of you, and I want to wish you only happiness and great health in the years that stretch ahead. Are you at work on another book or thinking about another book?
My husband is at work on a sequel to Trumpet.
Wow.
Yes, he is.
Well, it's hard to find time, but I do work on it.
And this is, I hope, in some way will be a yet another collaboration with the two of you.
Undoubtedly, in time it will. I'm letting him do the hard part.
Very good. Bill Hayes and Susan Seaforth Hayes, a great treat for me to speak with both of you today on the morning show. Very best wishes to both of you.
Thank you, my dear.
Thank you, Greg.
Here is one more little sampling of the talents of Bill Hayes. This comes from back in the golden age of television, back when one of the people who had their own variety show on television, the great Kate Smith. And this is a sketch, a comedy sketch and music sketch involving Bill Hayes and a castmate of his from Me and Juliet, Susan Lavelle. So you'll hear right off the bat Kate Smith herself and a sidekick offering some introductory remarks about the sketch that we're about to see, or a portion of it, that is, that we're about to listen to, I should say, in which the character of Bill Hayes plays a travel agent who is trying to help a young woman who's trying to figure out where she wants to take her big trip. So here's this little bit from the variety show starring Kate Smith, featuring Bill Hayes.
Travel Bureau, Ted, right out here on 44th Street,
yeah,
where you can get some very good ideas. Would you like to go with me?
No, I wouldn't, Kate.
Why not?
You know what happens now, don't you?
What?
We get rolled up on the screen and we become a couple of second story men again.
No fooling.
Yes, we do.
I'll be doggone.
Yeah.
Look, there's that nice young fellow, Bill Hayes, from the show Me and Juliet.
Uh-huh. Rodgers and Hammerstein, uh-huh, have been working in a travel bureau, huh?
Of course not.
Yeah.
We're just taking, should we say, literary license.
Oh, we ought to be more careful of our literary license or we'll get revoked, Kate.
Oh, I don't know about that.
I wonder what her license number is.
Now, wait a minute. That's Susie Lavelle.
Oh, yes.
Yeah, and Susie works in the show Me and Juliet, too.
Oh, yeah.
And she saved up enough of her money to take a trip abroad.
Oh, yeah.
And another thing, she's coming in to sort of pick a nice romantic country, you see.
Oh, looks to me like she's trying to kill a lunch hour, Kate.
Keep quiet.
She is.
Let's see what's going to happen.
How do you do, miss? May I help you?
Well, I was just sort of browsing.
Oh, had you contemplated taking a trip abroad?
Yes.
Where would you like to go?
Oh, anywhere.
When Irish eyes are smiling, how about Ireland? Or a Roman in the gloamin' on the bonny banks of Clyde.
No, I don't think so.
How about to merry old England, where you could watch the changing of the palace guard?
Hey, wait a minute. Hey, you're supposed to be helping me. What are you... don't you have some place that's more romantic, like, Brazil?
Yes, yes. I don't know why I didn't think about it. Yes, yes. I should have thought. Is not the islands fair that are calling to me? Is not the balmy air or the tropical sea? Is just a little brown gal in a little grass skirt, a little grass shack in Hawaii.
Well, I think Hawaii is beautiful, but I was really thinking about Europe.
Europe? All right. We'll fix an itinerary for you to Europe. Let's see. We'll get you a beautiful stateroom on the brand new SS America bound for London, where you can see the Queen's Return Festival. Get to Stockholm in time for the Hutsat Ralston on the Rilara.
Mm-hmm.
From there to Paris.
In April?
Beg pardon?
April. I hear that's the only time to see Paris.
Well, it's there year-round, you know.
You don't understand.
April in Paris.
Well, for the days when we got to enjoy things like this on network television, Bill Hayes and Susan Lavelle, castmates in Rodgers and Hammerstein's Me and Juliet at the time, in a portion of a sketch in which they appeared on Kate Smith's variety show. It wouldn't seem quite right if we finished up this tribute to Bill Hayes without hearing his number one record in its entirety. So, as he recounted in this interview, this was done in one single take, essentially on a single day's notice. So here is Bill Hayes' single biggest hit, his recording of the Ballad of Davy Crockett.
Davy Crockett, the king of the wild frontier. Born on a mountaintop in Tennessee, a green estate in the land of the free, raised in the woods so's he knew every tree, and kilted him a bar when he was only three. Davy, Davy Crockett, the king of the wild frontier. He fought single-handed through the Injun War, till the creeks was whipped and peace was in store. And while he was handling this risky chore, he made himself a legend forevermore. Davy, Davy Crockett, king of the wild frontier. Oh, when he lost his love, his grief was gall. In his heart he wanted to leave it all and lose himself in the forests tall. But he answered instead his country's call.
Davy, Davy Crockett,
the choice of the whole frontier.
He went off to Congress and served a spell, fixing up the government and laws as well. Took over Washington, so we hear tell, and patched up the crack in the Liberty Bell. Davy, Davy Crockett, serving his country well.
When he come home, his politicking done, why the big Western march had just begun. He packed up his gear and his trusty gun, and lit out the grinning to follow the sun.
Davy, Davy Crockett, leading a pioneer.
His land is biggest, and his land is best, from grassy plains to the mountain crest. He's ahead of us all, a meeting a test, and following his legend right into the West.
Davy, Davy Crockett, the king of the wild frontier.
The great Bill Hayes. Incidentally, a special award is being established in the honor of Bill Hayes through the NATS Foundation. NATS refers to the National Association of Teachers of Singing, and donations to that fund are welcome by going to the website of NATS, which is nats.org, and from there you can navigate to the donations page. My thanks to Bill Hayes and Susan Seaforth Hayes for being willing to be interviewed on the morning show, and my thanks to the niece of Bill Hayes, Joanne Hayes Bozeman, for her assistance in making this memorable interview happen. Tomorrow on the morning show, we preview for you a marvelous documentary which airs tomorrow night on the PBS series American Experience called The Big Burn. It refers to the establishment of the U.S. Forestry Service in the early 20th century and to the difficulty which those first rangers had both in taming fire and in taming the chaotic, rough-living men who lived out in the Far West at the time, and about a monumentally serious and destructive wildfire which broke out in 1910. We'll talk about the Big Burn on tomorrow's morning show. Today, partly to mostly sunny skies, quite cold, a high of 15 degrees. Overnight, mostly cloudy, a low of 6 above. Both tomorrow and Wednesday, a cloudy period with a 30% chance of light snow each day. Daytime highs in the mid-20s. Incidentally, the Kenosha campus of Gateway Technical College, which initially was opening at 10 this morning, is now closed all day long.